Welcome back, everybody, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. We have a very interesting episode today. We have a gentleman, I call him Dadvocate because that is his moniker on Instagram. We met on Instagram because I am surrounded by, in my community of Instagram followers, divorce mediators, divorce lawyers, and parents who have gone through divorce or are going through divorce. And so when I saw Dad Advocate, by the way, welcome Dad Advocate.
Hi there, Judy.
So when I saw you on Instagram, the post was about the English court systems. So you are in England. This is about the English court system and how you felt it was very unfair in your divorce that it appeared that the court system favored women, mothers, when looking at what we call custody. Is that right, Dad Advocate?
Yeah, that's right. I think financially and also to use the term custody, which we can talk about in a sec. But yeah, I think it's probably not intentionally. And I think on paper, the law is supposed to be fair, but there does generally tend to be a bit of a bias towards women in the process of both.
Well, you know what I think may have started a change in our culture in terms of how the court system looked at men versus women as nurturers and providers? I think it started with the film Kramer versus Kramer. It was a landmark film with Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep. It was in 1979, and it happened in New York State, but it was the first time that a man was given sole custody over the child, which was amazing. And just as a little background, I was thinking about this and see if this makes sense to you. I was thinking, well, okay, when did this whole model start of women are more nurturing than men? I kind of think it came out of the old culture where mostly men worked, women didn't, women stayed home, raised the children. But then that changed in the 70s too. And 80s, because women were working more, therefore childcare was needed more. And then when I got into this business, which was about 9 years ago, I was amazed at how nurturing men were. I was really amazed. Women hadn't gotten to that point yet. You know, when we're mediating divorces, everybody is in fear mode. Everybody draws their lines in the sand, and everybody wants what they want until a neutral people come in, professionals, and start really dealing with law. So let's start with, when did you file for divorce?
So from that, that's a good question. That would be 4 years ago.
Okay, so this is 2020, so 2016?
16, yeah. So, in fact, I didn't file. I gave my ex the opportunity in mediation to either file or I would, because she was sort of dragging her feet. And I think we'd got to a point where I wanted to move things along. And so because of the grounds that you have to cite to apply for divorce, I wanted to give her the opportunity to apply.
If you could just be a little closer to the microphone.
Yeah.
It would be better. Thank you.
There you go. That's all right.
This is raw and unedited podcast,
all right,
man. All right. So in the English court system, you do mediation. You try mediation before filing?
Yes, you have to tick a box on the form to say that you have tried mediation. However, what that ends up being is you book an appointment with a mediator. So what my ex did, we were seeing a mediator that was a lawyer, and she wasn't getting what she wanted. So she applied for divorce and gave a completely different mediator's details, where she obviously went along. So you basically got to go along, show your face at a mediator on your own and say, well, my ex isn't here, they don't want to mediate, therefore you can justify making your application to the court system. It doesn't mean anything. You are not made to go to mediation. You're expected to, but proving that you did is literally nothing more than a paperwork exercise.
Okay, that sounds good, because we have mediation too, but it's after you file for divorce if it's going to be handled by the court. Sounds like this was handled out of the court system, not a private mediator.
So you've got public mediators, you still have to pay, but they're quite cheap, or you can pick a mediator who can be a lawyer. We chose a lawyer that was recommended to us, because they hopefully help mediate an agreement that will be legally acceptable, and therefore you're more likely to have it signed off by the court. So no matter what divorce agreement you come to, it still has to go before the court to be approved and signed off. So you need to make sure that it's realistic and that you're not making agreements that a court won't be happy with.
Okay, and so when you say it has to be signed off by the court, we have a phrase called out-of-court settlement, meaning you file with the court, but you don't have to actually go there if you can settle terms, put them in a document called a settlement agreement, and then file that. Is it the same thing?
Yeah, so you can essentially, if you can come to an amicable agreement, you can put it before a judge, and you avoid the full-on court process, which is probably what you're talking about. So we didn't end up there. We went through the court system proper. But yes, if you can come to an agreement, you just need it to have it approved, and you avoid all of the usual or more expected court appearances.
But unfortunately, that's not how your divorce transpired. You actually did have to make appearances, correct?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And that's when you saw that perhaps the court system was still in the old model of women are more nurturing, women can take care of children better than men?
Yes. So children and money are two separate issues in the UK system, and they can be dealt with together, but most of the time they are separated into there's money proceedings, there's financial proceedings, and there's children proceedings or child proceedings. And so we went down the financial route, and it was very, very, it had been very, very difficult trying to get any cooperation out of my ex. She would always come up with a reason or be obstructive to us agreeing 50-50. I would accuse her of doing that, so there was a financial incentive, because we have a thing called child maintenance. So if two parents don't parent equally in time terms, the parent that has them less has to pay the parent that has them more. So there is a financial incentive to a parent to use children to get money. So everyone told me, including my lawyer, that once you've come to a financial settlement, the child issues will go away. She'll be more cooperative. It's all about having financial security. And so I went along with that. Sure enough, we came to a financial agreement, and the very next day she contacted me to rearrange under a very plausible, reason to go 50-50 on the childcare. And that's how it was with us sort of making plans about 6 weeks in advance, until she then decided she wanted to go and live in Scotland, which is another country here in the UK. And, I opposed it. And then she became very, very difficult again. And she became so difficult this time that I then initiated child proceedings in court to come to what you would probably call a custody agreement. We call it a child arrangements order.
So we did get child arrangement what?
Child arrangements order. So we have court orders. So it's the same as, I guess.
Child custody.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me get this straight, because it's the same thing here that we have child support, you call it maintenance.
Yes, that's right,
And then we have what's called the co-parenting schedule, which is a percentage of time the children are spent, and you have two girls, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So if that's the amount of time that the children are spend with each parent, but they're interrelated. You can't do one without the other. So when we run this software program, at least in California, called the DisoMaster, what a horrible name. Of all the horrible language you have to deal with in divorce, that word DisoMaster, it's short for dissolution, and it is the master of all calculations. But anyway, it's the starting point to a conversation. One of the key aspects of running that is the percentage of time that the children are with each parent, along with many other factors like what you each make gross monthly.
Yes, so it's the same system here, really. So you have, although I think it's probably less formulaic, so if you don't do parenting 50-50, there is a calculator on the government website, and you put in how many nights a week they spend with you, and you have to put in your gross salary, and it will churn out a figure. Now, that is called child maintenance. That is specifically for the maintenance of children, and it is directly proportional to the amount of time they spend with you both. Two other maintenance terms you have is global maintenance and spousal maintenance. So spousal maintenance is, say, one parent, one party in the divorce was a very high earner and the other party didn't have a job, was a very low earner. It would probably be expected that you both have to be able to survive and have a lifestyle. And so the higher earner would probably end up having to agree to pay the lower earner or the non-earner an amount of spousal maintenance. And what global maintenance is it's an umbrella term to incorporate child and spousal, and it's an alternative to. So child maintenance is directly proportional to the amount of time you spend with your children, which I think is, I understand the reasoning for it, but I think it is fundamentally flawed because it does reward one parent for keeping the children from another parent for financial gain. So what we agreed on was a global maintenance figure, which is capped. It's not proportional to the time that the children spend with me. Therefore, she had no reason to keep them and all the issues went away. That payment is fixed. It doesn't go up. It doesn't go down. She can't and she cannot apply to get any more money from me because that cancels it out. So you take a bit of a gamble, really, because if you go down the route of paying child maintenance, you are victim to them decide changing their mind and making it difficult to see your children, therefore they would get more money. Whereas the global maintenance figure, it caps it. It takes away the power, power that probably shouldn't be there.
Well, what happens if the payor loses their job or something happens with their company? I mean, we've got this pandemic.
Here we go. Well, That's the position I'm in right now. So I'm on 50% pay at the moment, and longer term, I think there's going to be, there is going to be some very large pay cuts for everybody. So I am at the moment not paying the global maintenance because I've earned 50% of my salary. I don't know anybody that's lucky enough to have 50% disposable income on top of their normal outgoings, etc. So for the period of those 3 months, in order to meet my own outgoings, I haven't been able to pay her. So the principle of maintenance is it comes out of your earnings anyway. It's not money that you pay. It's not a fine for being divorced or leaving somebody. It is a figure that you pay proportional to your salary. But if you have a massive drop in salary, how can you pay it? However, because we approached her, my lawyer and I, to say, would you vary it for at least 6 months because we don't know what's going to go on? And she totally ignored all of the letters until the point where I had to just not pay her. And
of course, that forced. Is this recent times? Are you referencing?
This is now. This is now. Okay. Yeah, this is right now. Okay. So I am currently in breach of our court order to pay her this maintenance, and I'm waiting basically for the a paperwork to turn up where her making an application to court to have it enforced, and we'll have to go to court and it'll cost more in legal fees. But there isn't, so if someone doesn't earn the money, you unless the other party will agree to vary the arrangement, you're forced into a position where you're probably going to end up going back to court and having a judge decide whether they think it's reasonable that you weren't able to pay or not. A friend of mine literally went to court today for this very reason, and the court ordered that he had to back pay all of the maintenance, even though he has earned nothing for the last 3 months.
This is horrible.
It's so unjust, and it seems to defy logic. And I think probably this is where the British legal system is a little bit, I mean, it's progressed a lot, but I still think it's probably a little bit behind. And it doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't compute.
Well, and that is different here, because I was so proud of the family law community in Los Angeles. Once the pandemic hit and everybody had stay-at-home orders, those who had already determined child support, maintenance, and or spousal support were calling their attorneys to say, well, my income has changed, and what do we do? Or the people receiving it would call their attorneys and say, well, I'm not receiving what we had decided. And all the attorneys were of the same mind. Everybody has to work together. This is an unusual situation.
Yeah.
And we do modify. Our court systems actually modify. In fact, in the child support section of the settlement agreements, we have to put the phrase or the sentence, child support is modifiable. And it's always based on the changing incomes of both parents and the changing co-parenting schedule. Because what you determine is your co-parenting schedule just to get through the divorce, especially if you have young children, will inevitably change as they get older.
Yeah, so I think if you're going to talk about child maintenance, then the same would be true here, because that is a variable amount based on the number of nights the children spend with you and the gross weekly income that you earn. So if your income went to zero, you wouldn't be paying any maintenance. So that is true. But what I'm caught up in is I have this global maintenance,
global,
which isn't variable.
Yeah.
It's a fixed amount and you're expected to pay it. And the only way to vary it is by agreement or going to court. My ex is never going to agree to vary it, because I think she sees it as my penance or my penalty for daring to divorce her and leave her. And she thinks she's entitled. It's all about her entitlement. So I am forced into this position where I'm going to clog up the court system. And I think what happened to my friend this morning was he fell foul of a judge that he'd had before, who he felt took a dislike to him. I can't really comment on that, but I think you are also slightly victim to the judge you get on the day. So my experience when we went through the court system was there was this big hype around finding out what judge you had and doing your research on that judge and the rulings that they'd made previously. And so there does seem to be a little bit of inconsistency with the person you get on the day. And of course you can subsequently appeal it, but that costs a lot of money. So it's not easy to get necessarily a fair outcome. It's expensive. And so anybody that doesn't have the funds to pursue will not necessarily get a fair outcome.
So I think what you just said was brilliant in terms of knowing the judge that has been assigned to your case and looking at the different rulings, because one of the things that people talk about, even in my office, and I'm a mediator, I don't go to court, I do file for amicable divorces, meaning people want to try and work things out, but I never go to court. If they have to break off and go to court simply for that portion of the divorce that deals with the children, or if somebody comes in my office for a post-divorce modification of either the schedule or the money, the question is always, how do you think the judge will rule? And interestingly, I attend a yearly seminar that deals with prejudice. And one of the panels is a panel of judges, generally 10 to 12, that literally talk about their prejudices. And they all say, we are human beings. And we had to recognize when we got into the position of being a judge, we really had to pay attention to what our prejudices are. And so you're so right that on any given day, any judge can just not feel kindly towards the topic or the people standing in front of him or her. So that's going to happen. That's life. But more than that, you can see a pattern maybe of rulings by different judges.
Yeah.
So let's get into where the unfairness is or the slanting in the English court system towards women when it comes to children.
If I could... Are we going to talk about money as well, or do you want to?
Anyway, I want you to approach this anyway. I want people to understand.
So I'll sort of answer that together. So, in financial terms, when we went through the financial proceedings to actually get divorced, because divorce in this country is actually about coming to a financial settlement and not really one about children. Children is up to you. You make an application or you get on with it, and they want you to get on with it between you and not bring that into the courtroom unless you cannot agree. So when we went through our financial proceedings, which was basically our divorce, because my ex was being so difficult and uncooperative, is the way my kind of work was going. I was having to take unpaid leave. We were able to take parental leave by law here in the UK.
Even men?
Yeah, men. You can take. Huh. It's any parent with a child under the age of 18 can take. It's 18 weeks. In total, in that child's life from 0 to 18. So in theory, I've got two children, therefore I've got 36 weeks I can take. It's unpaid, and it's at your employer's discretion. It has to be acceptable, I think, to their business needs is the terminology they use. So I was doing this to try and make sure I could be around for the sort of random dates that I could get her to agree to. She had been, when we were together, working full time. She was now claiming that she could only work 2 days a week because of our children, and she had to be there for them, and therefore her earnings were very low, which wasn't true, because I was there, and I was sat at home without our kids. When I could, you know, and I've always been a very involved, active father. I've definitely always been a 50-50 parent. And so she was claiming in court that she could only work 2 days a week and part-time. And a female judge, and she was, her solicitor was counter, sort of claiming against me, going, why is he taking unpaid leave? He shouldn't be doing that. He should be earning this and paying my client this. And the judge looked down her glasses, over the top of her glasses, at me, and just said, "Your salary is reduced. Why? That's you need to be back on full salary." And I remember thinking, "Why am I being targeted and criticised for taking time off to see my children or our children, when she's literally sat in the same courtroom claiming she can only work 2 days a week when she has clearly demonstrated that she can work five before and previously with our children in school?"
Okay, hold on 1 second, because this is so very important. So your ex-wife initiated that she had to reduce her time at work now that there were two households in order to rear the children. And there was no problem with that? There was no issue? There was no...
No questioning of that. No criticism. Yeah, I was directly criticised for taking unpaid leave to do the same.
Okay.
Parental leave to do the same. And I felt that really spoke a lot, that there was never any questioning of her earning potential, which I believe is what should be doing. So the legal system is supposed to deal with that. And that shouldn't have happened, but it did. And that judge on that day criticized me and didn't say a word to her.
Okay, so let me ask another question, if I may play devil's advocate.
Sure.
So your wife reduced her hours. She didn't eliminate temporarily. Why didn't you reduce your hours instead of eliminating completely but temporarily?
So why didn't I go to part-time?
Correct.
because I felt that would have been disingenuous and wrong. And actually, financially, I don't think it was viable. I think from knowing what needed to be paid for, and I knew that I was going to have to pay some maintenance to her, I felt it was wrong to, English term, play silly buggers. So it would be wrong and dishonest to play that game.
Okay. Is she full-time now?
Yes. So she is now earning, so we got divorced with her claiming that she could only earn £22,000 a year. She is now earning £80,000 a year, and I'm still paying her maintenance. So she claimed for her maintenance on the basis of being a very low earner, yet she is earning over three times what she was when we got divorced.
And earning more than you are earning now, correct?
Just under. We're not far off each other now.
You're not far off each other. What if the tables were turned at some point after Global Maintenance was established and she out-earned you? Do you still have to pay? Because
Yes, you do, because it's the order, it's the agreement you came to, unless you wish to vary it. So you have to, the only way you can vary that agreement or vary that order, sorry, is by agreement or by another application to court, which is, I think, is the position I'm about to be forced into, where it's clear, we know that she's earning at least three times what she said she was earning before. And I am not earning what I was and cannot afford it. And if she issues an application to enforce our financial order and try and get the money that I haven't paid for the last 2 months out of me, which I don't have, it's just not there, I wasn't paid it, then I will have to counter-apply with an application to vary the maintenance down to zero, because it's clear she is earning a lot more. So the court system financially here, it's all about need. It's not about what you're entitled to and what you deserve, and it's not about servicing people's revenge, if you like. It's about need. So she has to prove that she needs the money. A need is about looking after the children. Now, we now do 50-50. We have a court order that says we do 50-50. It's very rigid. I applied for it because she was being so difficult and I got it. And so the need that she claims she had now doesn't really exist. It's whether you want to go through the court system paying thousands of pounds to prove it.
All right, so that's the maintenance end of it. What about the co-parenting side, the time spent? How do you feel the court looks at that? Even though you say they're the means of least resistance, they really don't want to handle it. But when they have to, do they want both parents to have equal time with their children?
Yeah, I think the court system is probably more progressive than the social one here on that one. So the court system doesn't really suggest that women should be the dominant parent, but it tends to happen because women by default in the UK have parental responsibility over their children. Men have to meet one of three criteria to get it. So they don't get it by default. I mean, it's very simple. You have to be on their birth certificate. You have to be married to the mother. It doesn't take much, but actually a father by default is not given parental responsibility.
What's the third? I'm fascinated. You said there are three.
You've caught me on the birth certificate. Yeah, you've caught me on the spot on that one. They have to apply. They have to make an application to court to get it. So I guess that covers the scenario where a woman gets pregnant without the father's knowledge, has the baby, and the father subsequently finds out. They then have to apply to get that parental responsibility, whereas the mother by default has it. So I think there's a little bit of unfairness there, really. And then I think my probably bigger issue is with the social system, where everyone talks about custody, which is it's not actually a term here in the UK. It's quite outdated. We have residency. So where do the children live? And we have joint residency because they live with us both. Even if they don't spend 50-50 amounts of time, they still reside with us both. And I think that the court system does talk about a main residence. And I think that's wrong. I don't think you should say that just because a child spends 60% of their time with one parent and 40% of their time with the other one, that you should say that one is their main home and one isn't, because they don't see it like that. Children think they have two homes, and their homes are where their parents live. So it's not a particular house, and I don't think it, even if a child spends one night a week with one parent, it still forms one of their homes. And so I think that's probably one of the parts of the system that probably is a bit flawed. But the thing I got was people say to you, oh, do they live with their mum? Does she let you see them much? And how perverse is that? Why would I? It just, for me, I couldn't believe, I still can't believe when I get asked this, that people seem to think that the mother has the power, would by default have the power, and also it would be up to her whether I saw them or not.
I totally understand what you're saying, because that is the way we all used to talk about this, I guess, until around 1980 or so. A little offshoot. So what if one parent has a substance abuse problem or anger management, aggression issues? How does the court system look at that? Do you have to bring that up in court as a risk for that parent to be with their child?
Yes. So if you want to make an application about children, which presumably is going to be about where they spend their time or to have more residency than the other parent, yes, you have to make an application to court, and that is where you would cite those concerns. There was a risk to children that was that serious, presumably the school or some other local service might flag that up. And then there would be an intervention from the sort of the social services system here in the UK. They would intervene. But otherwise, if there's a substance abuse that you're concerned about or negligence, you would cite that in your application to court. As part of the court process, usually a social services that are under the court umbrella would be assigned your case. So when we went through our child arrangements our child proceedings, we were both interviewed by social services, and so were the children. And that is where the emotional abuse and the sort of mental manipulation of our children was uncovered by that social services, and sort of vindicated me to a certain extent in what we went through.
Would you like to share what you're referencing a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, as I said, she applied to take them to go and live in Scotland. And as part of that, she set about trying to make a case that they didn't see me that much every month. They sort of spent 8, 9, 10 nights a month with me. Therefore, it would be practical and logistically possible to achieve that, even with her living 500 miles away. As part of that, she also basically tried to get the children to say they wanted to go. So when they were, when we went to court, she'd been talking an awful lot to the children. They'd been getting very distressed and upset, and I was having to fend off questions. So I brought it up in the initial appearance in court and said that she's talking to the children about them and it's not right. And she was told by the judge that it was inappropriate and she shouldn't be talking to the children about it. The rest, we didn't go back for 3 months because there's always a delay. I think the court intentionally likes to give you several months in the hope that you'll come to an agreement between you. The social services came and, or they're called CAFCAS, they came and interviewed her. Then they came to me and they interviewed the children several times. And I think they interviewed the children in our respective homes. They wanted to meet my partner, see what she was like with the children. And then they interviewed them in a place that we agreed that they wanted to be a safe space where the children could talk freely. And it was that really that uncovered the level of manipulation that my ex had been using on them, in terms of lying to them about how far Scotland was away, how easy it would be. My eldest daughter, who was only 9 at the time, could recite train timetables. She could tell you what time the flights went. She'd been sat down in front of a computer to look at counting days on her calendar, and she'd been told that my job could change and that I could come up there. And I think the thing that was uncovered by the social worker was she said to the children, how do you know all of this about what's going on between your parents in court? What has dad said to you about it? And they both said, and this is quoted in the report, that dad hasn't told us anything. He said that the judge had told him and mum that they weren't allowed to talk about it to us, and so he hasn't. And she said, well, what how do you know about it then? Mum told us everything. And so the undoing really was the level of pressure and persuasion she levelled on the children to and a completely inappropriate level. And she still does it now. Her way of getting what she wants is to discuss things with the children and then ask me or say, this is what they want. And we all know with children, you can be very suggestive to them. You can offer things in certain ways. Children are very keen to please their parents. And so it is not right to ply a child first with an offer of something or an event or doing something, an activity, before you discussed it with the other adult. And this is her MO all the time, really. And it's her way of getting what she wants. But this was on an epic scale and it was uncovered.
So I guess at least in this instance, the system worked well as it should have worked then, this portion of the system?
Absolutely. I think it did. I think it was, I do feel like I actually, I don't know if you should term won, because I don't think it's about winning and losing. I think it was fair. And yeah, I think it worked for me. But the level of the amount of times I had to bring up the issues I was having with child access and cooperation with her to get to this point, I think is the problem. So you make an application, you get a court date 3 months later, you get, that's an initial little hearing, it'll be 10 minutes in front of a judge where they decide, the judge says what they want to see be brought to court, the paperwork, etc., for them to be able to make a judgment. That next hearing will be 3 months later, and if you can't agree at that hearing, you go to a trial, which will probably be another 3 months later. So the whole process takes somewhere between 9 and 12 months. When children are involved and not seeing their parent, that's a very long time to wait, and so much damage is done. And it shouldn't be so easy for one parent to block another parent out, alienate another parent, manipulate children, and it shouldn't be so hard and such a long time scale for the other parent to stop that.
And this was going to be my last question, and I think this is a good time for it, Dadvocate. If you could change anything and wave your magic Dadvocate wand to make the court system evenly balanced for parents, what would you do other than what you've already said?
I think I would make child arrangements mandatory before you can apply for divorce. So I wouldn't have the option to come to an agreement. You know, you can have the option to come to an agreement, but I would like, I think an order and a legally binding agreement should be made before you can apply to court for divorce, because then you can get the, you can take out the element of children being related to money or linked to money. And so, like we said, you have to say that you went to mediation. You have to say, have you got a child arrangements order yet? No, for it says, go away and sort one out. And it has to be properly looked into and overseen by the court system, and it's legally binding to stop the disproportionate or the lack of cooperation with regard to access being linked to money. Get that out of the way, and then your financial proceedings can be so much more genuinely about the need of each person, what each person can contribute. Because at the moment, although you don't have to come to agreement over children, if you don't, it causes, has so many implications on the financial side of things.
That sounds wonderful. And then for that to take place in the new scenario here, the people that would preside over the mediations, should they be as skilled and knowledgeable as the social services people who came in and finally uncovered the disparity in how the children were being communicated to by each of you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the mediators that I've come into contact with in this process have all been very good. They've been very knowledgeable. They've been wise to the techniques that people use. I don't think there are any rookie or left field ones that I encountered. So I think they're all pretty well informed. I think that really what you need is a set of expectations and rules to be defined by the court. And I think the default should be that parents do 50-50 unless it can be proven that something else should be done. And that might be that one parent isn't able. And not, I realise there are loads of, and probably men out there that don't want to parent 50-50. And all those guys have made my life, or people life for people like me, harder. It doesn't always work, but I think that the default starting point should be 50-50, and it technically is, but it's not really enforced. And so my ex was allowed to behave as she did until she got her money, and there was no retribution for that, really. And our children suffered, and that's, I think, my biggest problem. I don't actually care about the money. I never did. The thing I actually cared about was the distress that it resulted in my children being in. So I will never forget the days at the classroom door where my youngest daughter was being dragged off me by her teacher in tears because she'd only been at mine for two nights, and now she was going back to her mum for 5, 6, 7, 8 days, and all because she just refused to cooperate. She wouldn't agree to it. And I should have been more forceful, but bar going around and banging the door down and then presumably the police get called, you don't have any power. You can't do anything. As the parent who's being kept away, you don't have any power. You don't have anything you can do until you go through this legal system, which can take up to a year.
You know, my heart goes out to children all the time when I'm dealing with parents, and even parents who really think they're doing the best. It's so interesting that parenting is the toughest job of all when you're married and in a good household. But when you now have two households, parenting is unbelievably difficult, and you're going through your own emotional stress. Maybe your intention is not to place that on your children, but they pick up on everything.
Absolutely, they do.
And so now what you're doing, and this is how I would like to conclude our episode, and I'm so grateful for you taking the time to do this. Would you share with people your new endeavor, which is a podcast, is it not, and a blog?
What do you Yeah, doing? So I'm trying to, really, I've been meaning to do this for years, really, because I think I came out of the whole process feeling slightly aggrieved at how I'd been treated as a man financially, a man and a father. I couldn't believe the injustice of basically the blind eyes that were turned to the lack of cooperation that we've talked about with regard to the children. And then just the social one where people sort of, I still do think, expect the mother to be the main caregiver. And I wanted to sort of set up a bit of a resource and probably a place initially for me to vent for other men and fathers in that position. And then it evolved a bit because I subsequently discovered about 2 years ago that my ex is probably suffers from narcissistic personality disorder, which I think is a very misunderstood disorder. And I wanted to really support other men and fathers. I couldn't believe that there's no education at school about narcissism, because it's so toxic and it has caused so many issues for my children. And so really overall, I wanted to raise awareness of that, highlight the fact that men are sufferers, because I think the expectation is that narcissists are genuinely men, and they usually are, but there are women out there and they can be just as toxic as men. And so create overall, across all my social media, a bit of a resource to help support people, draw attention to it and educate and highlight the issues that I've had. And so from the website, there's a narcissism resource on there. The main channel is Instagram and Twitter, and I try and post stuff on there. And then the podcast really was just to tell my story. Hopefully people associate with it and understand it, and even maybe spot things that they didn't realize was happening in their own lives or somebody that's close to them. And then hopefully then to start talking to other people, not just about narcissism, other dads and stepmoms. And it's by no means really just about men. I'm not trying to promote men over women. I'm probably just trying to raise men and fathers up to the same level as women in terms of importance to their children.
This has been quite a journey for you too, not only through the divorce, but actually in your vehicle to help people. So how can people contact you, listen to the podcast, interface with your website? How do they get in touch?
So the website is dadvocate.co.uk, and basically that's the name is basically Dad Advocate, but it's just that shortened to Dadvocate. That's the idea behind it.
Would you please spell it?
So dadvocate.co.uk. Also on Instagram, Twitter, and social media, it's just Dadvocate UK. And the podcast is on all the usual platforms. And again, you'll find it under Dadvocate UK. But if you look on Instagram, you'll see the link to my website and you can find the podcast from there.
Excellent. And for anybody listening, I'm going to put Dadvocate in my liner notes when I post this on all of my social media platforms. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate the time that you took. Thank you so much. I am glad the journey is going better because it does seem like there's been progress, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's never over. It's not finished.
No, I know. It's evolving. How old are the girls?
They will be 12 and 10 soon.
Okay, so you still have some time. I understand 18 yeah. and graduated from high school. The equivalent is the same in the UK.
Yes,
as
yeah,
in
that's
here.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dadvocate, for joining us. And I also want to thank all of you for listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I am Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. You can get in touch with me through my email address, which is Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com, Judy at constructiveuncoupling.com. Be a subscriber, share this with your friends, and I think we'll all be far more informed and better at this whole gig called divorce. Thank you, everybody. Talk to you next week.